Oh, that's a nice thing to record them all. Gosh, I never looked those up. Gosh.
Yeah. It's on our webpage.
Yeah. It must. You have by now. You must have a huge menu. Hundreds of talks.
Yeah. Basically, everything that they'll past year or year ago.
Gosh.
So yeah, that's right, about 500 talks.
I'll have to go access it. And the audio is available.
On about half of them.
Wow.
Half or more.
And the viewgrass.
Yeah.
Gee whiz. Wow, that's great. Yeah. Normally you don't need...
Internet marches on.
Gosh, it sure does. That's the problem, is that there's so much on it. It becomes just a gusher again. Yeah. We'll wait for Roger to come back, I guess. What are you working on now, Lily?
Well, time variations and accretion disks.
Mm-hmm.
And starting to think about some other things, these intriguing observations of 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 solar mass black holes, which may or may not exist in galactic nuclei, but not at the center.
Wow.
The whole thing could go away, but it's interesting to think about that.
Yeah, it sure is. Indeed. Huh. Actually, I can just say as preliminary introduction that the thrust for this work was to try to find out what relativistic systems do in the laboratory, particularly in their radiation, because I've always been a little suspicious of even things like you look up in Jackson and you see synchrotron emission, and you ask yourself, how much of this has actually been measured? Astonishingly little. There's a very small empirical basis in the laboratory for most of this. Of course, it's a straightforward calculation, but that doesn't mean that nature has to do the same calculation. Okay. I was saying that the motivation for all this is to look at a system that is deliberately made beam-like, in that you have a beam moving through a plasma. So it is like a jet coming to terms with its external environment. I do not assume that the jet has, in fact, cleared away everything. And all you've got is a plasma that's moving relativistically with respect to us, and then it's just sitting there and moving forward. First, because it seems to me that there's always going to be some weather for a jet. There's always going to be stuff getting in the way. Certainly that's true at the front of a jet, by definition. So that I tried to look at the things to make as much of a comparison between injecting relativistic electrons into a magnetic and plasma environment in the laboratory, and this is on a scale of meters, and that of jets of whatever kind. I mean, you then have to, of course, use taste in describing, in selecting which effects you think really are relevant to your particular astrophysical case, whether it's from solar coronal all the way to relativistic jets from black holes. It requires some selection, as always. Because there's a limited amount you can do in the laboratory. And we don't have the resources that God did, so we don't have the same scales available either. The experiments I'm going to describe here are in a lab situation where the propagation vessel is about as long as this table for a relativistic system, and therefore things happen very quickly. So all these measurements are done on a time scale of 100 nanoseconds or less, because that's how long you can develop a relativistic pulse. They require a lot of energy. This is MeV electrons, therefore gamma is 3, but they have enormously high currents, 100,000 amperes of current. Why do you go to such high currents? Because first, the technology is available with that. But second, if you want to look at non-single particle effects, you have to have a lot of particles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you want the entire effect to grow to fruition and occur in a distance of a few meters, you have to have densities, beam densities, that are in the region of 10 to the 10th or 10 to the 9th, very high. And the background densities are in the range of, say, 10 to the 13th. That is, they are 3 or 4 orders of magnitude larger. There are several reasons for this. Yeah, for CC, right. The reason for selecting this regime is first that it's doable, and it leads to effects that you can see on a time scale commensurate with the size of the experiment. But it's also So that you can establish, by the way, that return current we were talking about. Because the system really achingly wants to take care of the return current problem because you had 100,000 amperes flowing through the system and you build up a lot of charge right away. And so the jet, the beam, will always try to find a return current path. And in these experiments, the return current, even when it's fairly highly rotating, is returning through a background plasma because the walls are this far away. Or in fact, they're down below the floor. So that, in a laboratory at UC Irvine, in a basement. The basement's required because we have to have shielding around it because the X-ray flux, when these electrons hit the wall, is not trivial. It goes into the dirt.
Another introductory question. In particle accelerators and the big light sources, that's synchrotron radiation, which is always basically incoherent.
Well, that's exactly what this talk is about, is to determine whether synchrotron emission is always incoherent.
Yeah. I mean, in those examples, I believe it is
incoherent. It is always incoherent, but there are the E-beam experiments, in fact, some were done here, where you have these modulated magnetic fields.
Yes.
And that makes them coherent.
Those are lasers.
Oh, so you're saying by the time we get the free electron laser.
Free electron laser.
That's an example of where they're coherent. Yeah, okay.
Right.
Is there any pulse size? Is there any evidence of coherent radiation?
In fact, is there any evidence for anything that's not coherent? I mean, all the radio emission is coherent, incredibly coherent. Yeah, and most of the bulk of the radio emission from Jupiter is coherent. In fact, coherent radiation is very common in from magnetospheres. So the point of this experiment was to. Yes, right. Conversation is stochastic. So the point was to ask the question, how hard is it to make emission from relativistic systems coherent when you start out with, say, the conditions for incoherent synchrotron, and then how plausible is it that it occurs in some kind of astrophysical circumstance? And is there a way to distinguish it? And the short answer is there may be, by looking in radio astronomy at the ratio of polarizations, a way to tell if the source is a coherent or incoherent emitter. And just to give you the final conclusion, the reason is you may be able to see diffraction from the bunches that are doing the emission. Single particle emission comes from infinitesimal little electrons, but collective emission comes from things that have a finite scale and can cause diffraction. Then it's a question of whether you can see this effect in astrophysics. You can in the lab, but that's the point of this talk, is that we do find that there's such an effect in the laboratory. Well, here's the experiment. You cause a bunch of relativistic electrons to have a high pitch angle. You do that by putting them through a magnetic cusp that's even before they get into the plasma. So they enter at a high pitch angle, going around like this, and the beam itself is about this big across. That is to say, it's a small cylinder of moving charge carrying 100,000 amperes, but it's relativistic. There's a background plasma, and the first thing you know is that it's going to excite an instability. The instability occurs at the hybrid frequency, which is this, which is close to within about 10% of the plasma frequency. That's the cyclotron frequency. And omega P is the plasma. What this does is produce clumps of charge. This is an electrostatic instability moving at a high pitch angle because you want that to couple to the synchrotron emission spectrum because, of course, synchrotron emission is due to the motion of electrons perpendicular to a magnetic field. Magnetic field is in this direction. The return current, there is some self field here. I'll neglect it from now on, but in fact, the current returns in this volume, and we measured the return current. It drops off basically is like 1 over R toward the boundary, and a small fraction, like 10%, flows in the actual metal container, if we're using a metal container. In this case, we were not, of the walls.
So rho L is a lot more radius?
Yes.
And the BZ is there to start with.
The the BZ is large, and it's there to start with. It's to keep the beam transporting down the chamber and to not have it hit the wall.
Well, and also, that's what
it's what makes it do this.
Right. So, But the induced current, am I doing this right, must point in the other, the induced field must point in the other direction and partially
transverse. That's true. Well, there are two induced fields. One of them is for the current that's going this way. The other is for the current going this way.
Right, right.
So, in fact, you get a helical return current. You have a helical current coming out. You have an opposite helical current going back that's in the whole plasma.
But as far as the toroidal part of this current goes, mm-hmm. it's like a tremendous solenoid, you're producing a current that tends to cancel your EV.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, a field that tends to cancel your
EV. Right. Yeah. The plasma always acts to
Lenz's law
to not have a field in it if it possibly can, and it fails.
Okay. Yeah. But something else. Rho L, what is that in your system?
That's the Lorentz radius, and it's about this big.
That big. I guess the point is, this is large-ish compared with the size of your experiment.
Well, the experiment is about this one.
Transatlantic is 1% of it.
So yeah, that's right.
5% of it.
Yeah.
Which is a totally different order
from yeah.
what you encounter in any astrophysical system.
Of course, because God has a very large budget. And
yeah. So this is a somewhat different experiment
sure it is.
Than the one that God is performing.
Sure it is.
It makes it harder to get coherent emission out of God's device than yours.
It depends, because the what I'll argue is that the coherence depends upon microstructure, not the boundary conditions.
Mm-hmm.
After all, in the pulsar, you get lots of coherence out of streams that are far down in the magnetosphere, and they don't apparently really care about the boundary conditions out at the light cylinder. The emission comes from 1% of that distance. So you always have to worry about this. I mean, only God does the whole calculation.
The point is that there's a dimensionless number.
Yeah. Which is different.
Very different.
The ratio of the Larmor radius to the chamber is 0.05 in our experiment. In God's case, it's zero. So, or very close to zero. Here's the idea of the experiment. It's that you have a single particle spectrum which has harmonics in here. And I'll show you those harmonics in a minute. And what you would like to do is put the electrostatic wave spectrum on top of the maximum emissivity of the synchrotron spectrum to amplify this emission mechanism. This is electromagnetic, this is electrostatic. In Maser language, you're going to pump it with this source of free energy, which is driven by the kinetic energy of the beam, and pump it into electromagnetic emission so that you can see it. That's the basic scheme. And that's what we did, because you can tune the hybrid frequency by changing both the magnetic field and the plasma, and you can move it back and forth. You can change the magnetic field. It's about a kilogauss. You can run it up to 3 kilogauss, things like that. You can move this spectrum back and forth and map it over this. What we did was find the maximum emissivity, which occurs indeed when you move it right over to here, to the peak of the synchrotron spectrum. And you can see that because you can look directly for what you calculate in Jackson, and that's the synchrotron harmonics. You calculate the separation of the synchrotron harmonics, and it's this separation. This, by the way, is what you get raw. This is delayed. But we do this in order to look at dispersion and to separate them out. It's a technical detail. These are the top three harmonics. They're up there at around 25 times the cyclotron frequency. So we were able to map out synchrotron emission to know that it is synchrotron emission. When you see the harmonics, you really got good evidence that you know what you're looking at. Because, of course, there are always all kinds of emissions possible from a plasma that has a significant magnetic field in it. Right, and that's what we did next. Yes? Question? In fact, let me show you that you also know that you're looking at the right thing, because you can vary the pitch angle, as we did, and you can actually then measure the emissivity versus angle while we're doing the polarization measurement, and you can see that you've got a cone here being emitted at a given pitch angle of about something like 38 degrees. You can change the pitch angle and move this searchlight around. It's, of course, symmetric. I mean, if you look down here over at this side of the cavity, you'll see also the emission. It's a maximum out at a given angle that you can change. So it's a pretty good relativistic cone. It's the kind of thing that you see in Jackson, except Jackson one of the things I noticed after a while about Jackson is there's almost no data in Jackson. You know, there are all these calculations, you know, and pretty pictures, but you know, if you say, you know, who measured this, the answer is very often that it hasn't been measured for a long time. Yeah. Right.
Well, come on. People use synchrotron sources all the time. I mean,
yeah, they do.
Yeah. I mean, it is corroborated.
Yeah, sure it is.
Radiation.
But I just, if you look in Jackson and he asks, where's the data? There's very little in Jackson.
Strike. Right. Well, that's true. But,
yeah. Yeah.
I think that the accelerator designers always try to minimize synchrotron.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Oh,
it's they're very useful. I'm not saying that it's fraudulent. Yeah. All those illustrations in Jackson of the previous view graph are all theoretical plots. No data on them. Yeah. Okay. So what we did was say, all right, we've shown one thing, one principal thing. You can increase the emissivity of this system by 5 to 6 orders of magnitude just by tuning to overlap the electrostatic and the electromagnetic. Two questions arise. Can you do that in astrophysical source, which I can get to later? And the second is there anything new? I mean, are you just looking at single particle emission? So we started to look at polarization. We mapped the polarization. We found that if you just map simple polarization versus angle, you get the synchrotron result. So we started to look for other things. We looked at, in fact, the ratio of polarizations for several reasons. One of them is that you never see that plotted anywhere. It's a really complicated mess. The second, though, you alleviate the shot-to-shot variation. If you take the ratio of the emission, and you take two waveguides, say, like this, and you cross them, and you take the ratio between the two, the shot-to-shot variation goes away because of the fact that you are looking at a ratio, not an absolute value. Don't have to worry about the absolute emissivity, which has some jitter in it, as always, because the experiment's never, particularly when you're launching 100,000 amperes, sometimes it's 97, sometimes it's 102. There are all these absolute variations, so we'll try to look at ratios.
Is this a kind of induction accelerator?
It's a Marx generator, which is a very large set of capacitors in oil, which are discharged in 100 nanoseconds. We have a system that runs at a microsecond also, but it only gives you 10 kiloamps. Actually, we did some of these studies on that, too. So we looked at this. This is the drift tube, the axis of the drift tube. And we looked at two waveguides which are at the same place. They can have horns on them or just be bare waveguides. It doesn't change things a whole lot. And you can look down here, by the way, to look at emission at a different angle. And we cross the two, and then we rotate it in this angle phi. We can actually rotate the whole system like that so that you can map out the polarization for crossed systems and taking the ratio as a function of phi. And then you can calculate it from single particle theory. And that's where the principal body turned out to be buried, because here are plots of first theory. Here's theory under several different assumptions. You actually have to take... Yes, reversing the current. You have to take the actual measured power and compare it to the integral of the emissivity that you're going to get out of single particle theory. And in the integral, you have to include the receptivity of the waveguide. And that depends on whether you've got a horn or whether you've got bare, open waveguide. This is the naive theory versus phi. It's symmetric because as you rotate these waveguides, you rotate them through 90 degrees, they switch definitions. And so, indeed, it's symmetric. These are three different theory plots depending upon what kind of horn you use and so forth. The point is, these are all three theoretical calculations. They show that we should have seen a very large effect. We didn't. Here is the case where you use a horn, and here is where you use bare waveguide. Bare waveguide has a larger opening angle, and so you're tending to look at radiation from other parts of the tube. By the way, there's no reflection back in this tube, so you really are looking at emissivity. There may be, because you're using Pyrex, there may be reflections from way away in the lab, but it's much weaker.
And P is power.
And P is power, the power in the two different orientations, since the ratio of the two. You have to, To get this theory, you have to integrate the emissivity. This, however, integration is done by the system.
Over frequency.
Yes, right. Actually, we tend to look, we looked at a narrow band pass right at the synchrotron peak where most of the power is. But in fact, it was we could broaden that and look, say, at 10 harmonics, get the bulk of the power there. And in fact, that became a problem because we would like to look at the entire range, which runs from 0 to 30 gigahertz, but we were not always able to do that. So we just looked at the bulk of the power. However, we always kept, if we did that, we then, in the single particle power, eliminated the lower harmonics to keep everything straight. However, the point is that there's a huge disparity by factors of 4 or 5. The maximum of this curve is 1.5. Maximum of this curve, you can see, is 8 something. So there's a big effect, maybe a factor between 2 and 3 between theory and experiment. And we thought to ourselves, what can this be due to? Because it's really striking. It's not a small effect. Therefore, the collective process is really trying to tell you something here, that the single particle, that it's not single particle emission. The best explanation I could come up with is that this is due to the diffraction, which mixes the polarization states. Diffraction due to the fact that the unstable wavelength in this system is about this big. It's about a centimeter. That's the unstable mode between the beam and the background plasma. That's what the electrostatic energy should start out at. Now, what it evolves to, nobody knows, because these are very strong instabilities. But what we envision is in that first view graph is that you've got these relativistic packets of electrons coasting around in a spiral, going down the tube, wrapping around a few hundred times before they hit the wall, and they are radiating into your receiver. But you're looking at a whole family. When you look in at the beam, you're looking at a whole family of packets that are various angles, to be sure, but they're also coherently radiating, and they have a coherent length. So I did a simple diffraction theory and said, how much diffraction do you need? That is, what is the size of the radiating region that is necessary to get the diffraction that would so reduce this ratio? And that's a somewhat involved calculation, but it turns out that you end up with a coherence length that's about this large. The coherence length is about equal to the radius of the radiating tube of electrons.
The radius is?
Pardon?
Rho L.
Yeah, rho L. It's comparable to rho L. Which is striking.
Can I ask you to back up a second here?
Yeah.
Can you get back into the non-coherent regime and see large polarizations in the by detuning your hybrid resonance?
Yeah, we checked that. Yeah. You go back and you can look at, of course, we're only talking about 10 watts here.
So of course.
Yeah. But you can go back and look at it. And you can look at ordinary synchrotron and there is no such effect at 10 watts.
Yeah, okay.
At a mega, the radiated power here is 1,000,000 watts.
Yeah.
1,000,000 watts in photons at in the region of 20 to 30 gigahertz. So it's really a high-power experiment.
So
it's like a radio station.
What about also just injecting a lower current?
You mean to get the power down?
If you're seeing a coherent effect, because you're getting coherent, right, if you get a coherent emission, I would think if you just sort of decrease the current slowly, you would gradually get bigger ratio. You'd approach your higher ratio.
That we couldn't do because in a Marx generator, you can't take the current down to zero. There is a certain band in which you can fire. Oh, yeah, you could do that, but it's really, it's a lot of work. We didn't do it because it's a lot of work. Because these capacitors are in an oil bath. Right. And it takes a day to take the oil out, to take the capacitor out and put it back in, so there's a limit to what you can do. They're in oil, by the way, so they don't arc at 1,000,000 volts. The size of the radiating coherence is really striking. I had expected to come out with a size that was a fraction of the unstable wavelength, but it came out the opposite direction, which tends to mean that the whole structure is cooperating, which is really striking. And I don't know if that would be true in astrophysics. However, if you then ask the second question, hey, how could you observe this? Well, the answer is that maybe you could do it in radio astronomy, and you could see if you could look at a known coherent source, such as pulsars, and look at the Wright-Stokes parameters and see if you can see diffraction from radiating regions. You could also look in the intraday variability of AGNs and say, use the same ratio, look at it, and find out if it matches the single particle calculation.
But you know, it's actually performing that experiment that is over the physics department here.
Really? Yeah. With free electron lasers or what?
No, pulsar.
Oh, who's doing that?
Carl Grimm.
Carl Grimm? I don't know. He's doing it with pulsars. He's got.
He's measuring you practically there from the.
Really? I'd like to talk to him. I didn't.
You should do that.
Yeah. And he's.
Not yet.
Huh. Wow. What's he find?
Sorry?
What does he find?
Well, he finds. Well, first he's trying to get the size of the emission region.
Uh-huh.
And finds it's much larger than claimed by polar cap models.
Uh-huh. A big fraction of the light cylinder radius? Wow. And does he think that's. Well, the first theorist explanation would be, well, that's refraction. Right? Refraction inside the magnetosphere. So you spread, you have a small emitting region and then you spread it out over a large medium.
You can't get the light structure of the beam at that scale.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
That,
I would bet that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, I sure should. I didn't know he was doing that at all. I mean, I didn't know of it.
We'll put you on.
Okay, great. The second thing is, as I said, maybe you could do this in radio astronomy. Pulsars are the place to start. Actually, I wonder if anybody's ever done it for Jupiter. For the decametric emission from Jupiter.
Is there some advantage of doing it with Pioneer or Voyager relative to doing it from the ionosphere?
I don't know. The real problem is the fact that the wavelength is bigger than any receiver you'd have on a spacecraft, I would think. I'll bet that you get into troubles that way, but I could be wrong. I don't know. You mean for Jupiter? Oh, it's very big. It's very big. It's this big. I mean, If you could see in that region, you could see it with your eye. Yeah. And then the last thing is to look at AGNs and you look at the intraday variability, and when it's being variable, see if this kind of ratio changes. If so, it's a clear signature that it's a collective process, and then the theorists don't have to fight over it anymore. You can have an experimental chess.
Are you absolutely sure that this couldn't be imprinted by a refractor?
Well. Not at high frequencies, I bet, because, oh, I didn't mention. I tried to check the diffractive hypothesis here to see if there was a scaling. You would think it would go as lambda squared, but there wasn't enough difference range, and our sensitivity wasn't good enough to see the effect. But you could check that. Of course, refractive effect, scintillation goes as lambda squared because it's diffraction. I would hope at high frequencies it wouldn't be available to you. Scintillation effect.
Yeah.
So the thing to do is look at 20 gigahertz or something, if you can see the variability there.
What's the plasma frequency?
Oh, for this guy, it's 30 gigahertz. About.
And what was the same frequency?
It was about the same, because we were pumping one to the other.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So that's the peak of the synchrotron effect. That's gamma squared and omega c. So omega c is down by an order of magnitude. Omega c is roughly a tenth of omega p. Now, if you do that in astrophysics, what you're going, I mean, the essential picture is that you would have to have a rotating thing like this, and you have to have charge bunches induced on a scale smaller than the Larmor radius. So that means that the unstable electrostatic turbulence has to be smaller.
I'm not worried about this, Greg. I mean, what you're doing is you've got this field, basically that direction.
Yeah,
you're
the beam.
Injecting spatially a beam.
Yeah.
And you're putting that in, and then that beam is producing a bunching, essentially.
That's right.
You coherent emission.
Yeah.
But how likely are you to do that in an astrophysical environment? You've got this huge field. you select, you know, you've got your beam generator.
The jet goes along the magnetic field.
I understand.
With a high pitch angle.
Like to, you know, just have an isolated number of beams that are injected in this way that you have done. Because, I mean, essentially, the next field line ought to have overlapping...
It ought to have this.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, and they'll
yeah,
be...
Like, yeah, like that.
Yeah.
And then it's going to look awfully incoherent.
Well, it'll look like a superposition of a whole lot of coherent radiators. You can't make them incoherent if you stack them all up. But, yeah. What matters is whether all the electrons cooperate with the nearest, with the nearby electrons.
Yeah, but what...
Mm-hmm.
So I'm concerned about doing this in an environment where you aren't isolating certain field lines to gyrate about by placing your beam, you know, on those field lines.
By looking only at one field line.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
And when you perform the mm-hmm. average, I agree, you may still have some bunching.
So I think the bunches have to have a low spatial volumetric field impact.
Yeah, so let's talk about what the size scale of these bunches is. The frequency is the plasma frequency.
You mean the size scale?
Yeah.
L is on the order of the new observed, C over new observed. And this is gamma squared omega C, right, basically. So this is equal to, this is rho L over gamma squared.
It's 10 to the law, so I'm getting a bit confused now about how you get this huge code.
Why isn't it just the plasma frequency rather than the cyclotron frequency?
Well, because omega C, gamma squared omega C is about equal to omega P. That's what the tuning is.
Oh, okay.
That's why. But so this is omega P, P yeah. Now that's the size, but indeed that's why I drew this picture. The packets, the linearly unstable packets are smaller than the Larmor radius. However, the actual diffractive length that we infer is the size of the Larmor radius. And so you might say, why are these coherent at all? Because they're smaller than the Larmor radius. It's because what matters is the phase coherence between the emitting electrons. And because you're trying to say, well, how come this guy doesn't interfere with that guy, right?
He does.
Yeah.
Well.
But what you get is the number, I think, the number of electrons, number of electrons squared times the single particle emissivity.
Yes.
Okay. And then the number of packets. I submit that that's probably the total power. Because they just the packets single particle impel, but this is the basic emissivity of a packet. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's that simple. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, roughly. I mean.
But I'm wondering if you build up the bunching when you see lots of field. You know, there has to be some sort of reactive three-way coupling or something like that.
You mean
produce the bunching in the first place? Like, if you've got bunches, then you get a sort of number of electrons in the bunch amplification.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you really build up the bunching when you seed all field lines with rather than electrons.
Well, first the building of the bunches is done by the electrostatic wave. Then it couples to the electromagnetic wave.
Yeah.
Do you imagine this as, let's say it's the pulsar, you have the magnetic field, you imagine the instability of going in a sheet of, this is winding, but you imagine it being a sheet of charge, a gap of order rho L.
Yeah, it might
and
be.
Another gap like this.
Well,
charge sheets, well, you imagine the sheets all broken up, and then they're all moving as individual bullets, basically, along each individual field line, and then that's harder.
That is harder. However, that's the spaghetti versus the pancake model of 20 years ago, isn't it? Yes.
Pancakes are terribly hard.
Yeah, they are.
Does the pitch
Well, we found, well, it's just another tuning parameter. We varied the pitch angle between 85 and 30 degrees.
If you could imagine, if the pitch angle is small enough, you would overlap the successive.
You would mess it up.
So this is what, if Don Melrose were here, mm-hmm. he would give you a much harder time than we are based on his sort of writings and so on, mm-hmm. against sort of antenna mechanisms.
And
just on the basis, I suppose, of kinematics and that, you know, mm-hmm. what's going on in one beam is slightly faster than what's going on in the other beam. All that would become very coherent.
Yeah, I have two comments. One is that I've never seen a calculation of that effect from Don. Two, pulsars radiate coherently. Even Don will admit this.
Oh yeah, no.
But he wants a maser.
Not this mechanism.
He wants masers.
He wants masers.
That's one of the reasons that I started doing experiment 20 years ago, is that Don kept saying, no, can't happen. So I started to produce places where it did happen. I'm leery of this argument that if you overlap a whole lot of them, it will become incoherent, because the coherence is established on that scale. Oh, well, Landau damping is... Right. But look at it this way. You're approaching the Earth in a spacecraft. You look at it. It has a large number of radio stations. Every one of them is coherently emitting. If you listen to them all at one time, you'll hear nothing, but it will be radio bright with a high brightness temperature. They will not interfere and come out to look like single particle radiators.
But it did require lots of intelligence and forethought.
We didn't design that system to look that way from outside.
It did occur naturally to get eye level moving into the.
No, that's true. But
did you do an experiment with an incoherent sort of beam? I mean, when you do have sort of a big enough beam that your instability is. Not raw well, but it's much bigger than that.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. I wish I had the budget to do that. The reason here's the experimentalist reason.
Right.
You need the cusp field to put it at high pitch angle. And then you can only do that for a group of field lines. If you try to do it over here, you need another cusp field, which means another injection, and then you've got to marry them all together, and that's really a big job. Because it's really tough to produce high pitch angle electrons in the laboratory. I'm not so sure how nature does it, frankly, but I don't know. Maybe they're just born that way. Yeah. The standard thing is that flow along a magnetic field produces the Alfvén waves, which scatter them up, which gives you a higher pitch angle and radiation, you reach an equilibrium. That's the Jacobi stuff from 25 years ago. Now, I think these are all important considerations. I mean, how do you add together all these radiators? I think the analogy is to the Earth's radio stations, but can you observe this effect from afar? And that's why it would be really fascinating to see if you can do it at pulsar.
No, I
want to
pay for the book. I think it's very important that you do this picture, you might say, to
Tom
Gwynne, because he really is set up to doing this. Well, I'm not absolutely sure he's doing polarization, but it wouldn't take a lot for him to do that.
No, after all, what's his receiver, do you know?
Well, he's using the VLBA.
He's using the VLBA?
Yeah,
it's supplemented. Depends on the pulsar.
I'm not sure. Interesting.
He's done various things. I believe he's done VRC with the past. And he's done, in the past, he's done various ad hoc interferometers where he's getting by the telescope.
Yeah, and there's the group at Caltech. I haven't heard much from them in a while. What are they doing? The pulsar group.
They haven't done anything like this for
that. No.
They haven't done anything like this for ages. I mean,
you mean for Carney?
Not since Marty Ewing was there, did anything like this.
Street gamma reverse, and before that.
Yeah, but do you remember the pulsar meetings we had a few years ago?
Yes.
Yeah, who put those on?
No, but we have people from JPL.
Yeah.
This is theoretical, but there were no.
But they were doing observations. Remember, they had all this huge volume of observations, very fast time scale, microsecond scale.
Oh, no, sorry, you're doing that print.
Okay, then that's not doing, they're doing microstructure.
Right.
In pulses, and they have it's now nanostructure. And there is a student doing that. They could possibly do that. That's basically done out of Ernst Valley, or it was done out of Ernst Valley, although they have now some Arecibo data.
Okay.
So I'm just trying to think there, what the other
sort of a catalog of dimensions numbers in this experiment, right? So one is the ratio of the Larmor radius to the scale of the experiment. Another is the pitch angle.
Another is the Lorentz factor.
Right. We didn't fool with that much. We just used gamma equals.
Right. I mean, you do what you can, obviously. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously very interesting. But, we know the cyclotron lasers, they work when they're mildly relativistic, but not when they're ultra relativistic. And the reason is because you've got a sort of order unity change in the frequency due to the relativistic mass. And that gives you the discrete harmonics are sort of quite separated. And then they become continuous when you get to the synchrotron radiation. So that's just a caution that a theory that actually works for gamma of 1 or 2
may not
be appropriate for 100.
That's true, but that's why this isn't...
Get you thinking about it.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Of course, we don't know what the gammas are in these sources. I mean, we know what the radiating particles have as a gamma. We don't know what the flow gamma is. Maybe it's gamma equal 3. The bulk gamma.
The bulk gamma probably is pretty modest.
Yeah, it is.
But isn't it the
gamma of the electrons? It is. Yeah. You see, the problem is that astrophysics tells us that there's a complicated kind of jet. It's a jet that has a bulk gamma and then a relativistic gamma in it, a much higher relativistic gamma being carried along. In the laboratory, you can't produce that. Just can't.
We produce. Yeah, but we do understand. We trust the Lorentz information, so we just like we trust Jackson, he's just sharing the data.
Yeah.
I mean, we're sort of further behind than a lot of other stuff.
Yes.
There is some prehistory there. I seem to remember after synchrotron radiation was limited theoretically before we're seeing accelerators. There's actually a debate about what would be seen.
Yes, there was.
And then it turned out to be the answer is very simple. It just didn't be coherent.
It was actually worked out by G.S. Schott in 1912. Beautiful book. Everything right. And coherent processes.
Really? What book is this?
G.S.
I've got the name of the book. But, it's a huge thing. Book we're mostly concerned with. One of these sort of big essays. It's all correct. And then it was reworked out by Schwinger and others. And then Schwinger, of course, in a very complicated way, but very, very clever. And then other people worked it out for the huge class of electromagnetism. And they got exactly the same answers that Schott had got. But Schott also has things like bunches of particles and taking the limit of these bunches together.
I'll have to look at that book, I don't know it.
Yes,
Schott.
C-H-O-T-T. Hutchinson was the person in 1940, before Alfvén and Hertz and then Trotsky said that radio stars and so on might have synchrotron radiation.
Right.
But that was in the 1940s, but this
was
in 1912.
Yeah,
I think it was
just a mathematical equation, right?
Just using Maxwell's equation. And he did all the, a cat theory and so on for the whole
thing. That's what led me to do this, is the problem of the intraday variables is that the default assumption is synchrotron. Mm-hmm. But this is synchrotron emission that has a higher emissivity. Take the devil's advocate position and say, maybe most jets are radiating coherently and therefore have a higher emissivity. That lowers the energy budget in the jet. Period.
That's one way of thinking about this. Let's say there's a Lorentz factor of 10. Let's say you measure in the most extreme case of the brightest number of 10 to 21. We trust that.
Yes.
Let's say we 10 to 16, say, something like that, taking account of some
Actually, no, 10 to the 21, because if you just get one simple...
Yeah, one verse.
We have to be a little bit... Sorry, you'll get 3 powers of gamma for a variability brightness temperature.
Yes.
10 to the 18. So you've got it in the frame of the plasma, you're emitting 10 to the 18. And you do with mildly relativistic electrons.
Mm-hmm.
That means you basically need sort of 10 million, 30 million electrons per bunch.
Yeah.
So you need that sort of coherence, because you need 30 million electrons per cubic wavelength.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of minimum that you need to get that high brightness temperature.
Mm-hmm.
That's necessary. It's not sufficient, because you have to have some instability that's actually going to produce it.
Right.
But that's the necessary condition to get this coherence.
Yeah. And so...
And you could excite it perhaps in a shock front or something, some current-driven instability in the shock front.
That's one thing that kind of worries me about our modeling of jets, is if we've got the emissivity wrong, then it changes everything else about the inner jets.
Changes all the inferences about...
Right.
Now, another objection to this, which Paul worried about,
mm-hmm.
is if you have some black box that makes coherent emission, sort of sins of transmission as well as emission, in the sense that this coming out through the environment of the quasar, it may never make it out.
Yeah, but right.
If you use scintillation instead of variability bracket temperature, then it's you'll need a factor of 1,000. And so if you get a factor of 10 from the gamma factor, you'll need 10 electrons. You need 100 electrons to process.
Mm-hmm. So if you use scintillation, I'm saying let's take the variability.
Right.
Hmm. And let's suppose that we only have a Lorentz factor of 10.
Yeah.
As indicated, then that gets you from 10 to 21, doesn't it, down to 10 to the 18.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Right, the point is that if it's actually scintillation, then
every time you add scintillation on top of that, then you get it.
Yeah.
No, if you have that, you can have scintillation instead of that. The problem with scintillation is that you still need a bracket temperature of 10 to 14.
Right.
You get a factor of 10 of that from gamma.
Yeah. But that's much easier, but I'm saying ignore the scintillation. Suppose that Wagner, for example, is right. And so it's got nothing to do with scintillation.
Yeah. Or on the other hand, if we run out of ideas, we can use epicycles.
There you go. Yeah.
we're stacking one mechanism on top of another to get this explained.
If you only need a brightness temperature of 10 to the 13 intrinsically or something like that, how difficult is it really going to be to get the stuff out? Because we know that you can go...
Not at all. The problem is it's 10 to the 18.
Yeah, that's right.
So the thing that one has to look at is whether all of these sources can be scintillated.
The most important observational question, which has not been properly answered, is how important is scintillation for imposing the variability on the radio sources?
Yes.
Because the alarming brightness temperature comes from variability, not from inferences by angular size.
Right. Yeah. On the other hand, isn't that being defeated?
You still get papers after now, I suppose, about 8 years. From the one person who's been monitoring these sources, that looks like that we see it here.
The predictions are pretty recent.
Yeah, it says here tentatively connected to the R band variation. So here is the data in AO235.
So which is this?
So that you could believe is associated with that.
I could.
You could. You might believe that. That is a bit dodgy. Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be 3.6 centimeters.
This is how many centimeters?
And that is tentatively associated.
With this, which is the optical.
I mean,
there's going to be another problem with this, and that is that you're going to. It's not quite as simple as going up against the Compton limit and then boosting it by a factor of 1,000, because the self-absorption limit for free partition is going to be less than 10 to the 11.
Sure, we're going to be 10 to the 10 if we take Marder up. That's why I said 10 to the
8.
Because you've got to compare with the kinetic temperature of the electron.
So you may require sub-equal partition fields so that you can get the higher brightness temperatures past the synchrotron self-absorption limit. So that gives you more problems with your...
The brightness temperature is a third, in the program units, is the third of the energy of emitting particles, almost always.
The brightness temperature is the third of the energy?
Of the emitting particles.
Really?
Almost always.
Why?
3 kT is gamma and C squared.
Oh, I see.
Basically. And it always wants to work out like that.
So, I wonder if the biggest problem with this, I wonder if you have similar particles in these bunches, but not all of them, going to have synchrotron self-absorption problems. It's the biggest thing.
Well, they're not, these aren't thick, though. They're not synchrotron thick.
Right.
They're not big enough to be thick. They're only this big, these things, you know.
Yeah, no. But in between the bunches, they have to go through the medium.
Oh, through the medium.
Moving in and out of these bunches. And so
yeah.
Most of the electrons at any one time are probably not going to be coherently radiating.
That's right.
So you have to make sure there aren't so many of those electrons that it like, you know, absorbs out.
It absorbs out. Well, that's true. It never occurred to me that these would be so thick, because after all, the wavelength of this emission is about like this big, and the container's only this big.
Sure.
So you've got to have. I haven't evaluated.
But I mean, if we're dealing with a situation where the coherence is fairly mild, I mean,
it is mild.
Six orders of magnitude. I think you're in real trouble from all kinds of effects, like induced quantum scattering, all those kind of things. But if you only need a factor of 100, I mean, it may be reasonable. But then the question is,
self-absorption,
synchrotron absorption.
Yeah. Well, obviously, in the experiment, you don't, because we don't see it.
Yeah. You're not nearer.
No.
Yeah.
It's not self-absorbed. No. No. This brings up a further difficulty. You know, you've got this big gusher of emission coming out. Over what time scale does it clear a path so you can see it? I mean, you're going to stop it with all these stimulated Raman and all these other processes.
Look at time three bursts.
And it blows it out of the way.
The answer is very clear, given by Sterik long ago, about that distance.
Yeah, and it's wrong. Yeah, right. The Sterik's dilemma. But this is not a quasi-linear argument. That was Sterik's argument. You're using quasi-linear theory to calculate how fast this high brightness will get scattered to the side and you won't be able to see it anymore. But my question is, dynamically, how long did it take that high brightness spotlight to simply bore a hole so you can see it? Because it is a huge pressure.
Yeah.
How long does that take?
Well, no, it depends how. I think the question is, how nonlinear is it?
Yeah, well, that's
in the region where the density is. Remember, you're going through many decades.
Mm-hmm. You'd be far from the source.
You may
still
get
absorbing.
No scattering in the immediate vicinity of the source region for the similar reasons of what saturated time three bursts and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But Paul did look at this more carefully. But I would venture that stimulated Raman and induced constant would. Can still give you serious constraints on 10 to the 18 to 10 to 20 degree radiation as they propagate out of the source region, say, you know, the distance of the parsecs.
And the limit is set by what?
Well,
what? Stimulated Raman scattering? Or
Both of those can be enforced.
Yeah.
Paul did the induced constant, and I looked at the stimulated Raman and other instabilities, Levinson and it depends which particular frequency and scale we've got.
Yeah.
But they're pretty devastating for very conservative densities.
Yeah.
In the sort of region, that brightness density is 10 to the 18 and above. But the lower brightness density, which Mitch says you might be able to get away if you just rely on scintillation and not the variability.
Yeah.
Then it's not such a problem, and that could easily get
out. That's like an argument, but the synchrotron is more of a problem. Because you then got to produce these things at the 10 to 15 centimeters rather than 10 to the 18 centimeters, which is where you normally expect the radio photosphere to
fit. Yes. Then you get synchrotron.
Yes. So that's
synchrotron absorption. One of the old papers that I read was he tried to have proton synchrotron radiation.
Yes, right.
And that doesn't work. You heat up the electrons.
Then the problem is you heat up the electrons.
Yeah.
Even if you're up on the tail.
Yeah. And then you absorb it with the electron.
That's right. Yeah. The electrons will always get that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can get it to work if your conditions are very extreme.
Yeah. But is it obvious that you won't evacuate a channel? Because, I mean, you see, this problem occurs in pulsars.
Well, that's true. You can. There, what that depends on is, you know, dimensions like E over MC omega, which tell you what the equivalent frequency is in the electrons.
Right.
And when that becomes mildly relativistic, then obviously you've modified your own propagation. It isn't the passive medium for which you propagate.
Yeah, right.
But basically, when the equivalent frequency becomes larger, then that's also the signature that you're you've got non-linear effects coming up.
Yeah.
The quiver frequency.
Quiver frequency.
That's the
induced force.
Oh.
Yeah, quiver. Yeah, the wave causes this quiver in the background.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But that's one. We should be able to calculate that easily enough. How long does it take this a really high brightness source to tunnel through a surrounding medium and break out? Enhanced radiation pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the ponderomotive force.
Right.
Push
the east-west
type force.
Right.
Yeah. You can do that, and I think you, at high brightness temperature, you would do that first in the source, but there will still be a region further away where the electric intensity is smaller, the density is smaller, and still you have
scattering
where quasi-linear theory ought to be appropriate.
Yeah. Eventually, you'll lose to some thinly populated region down here. Okay, why does this argument not work for pulsars? Because pulsars are in the same problem. They have too much scattering. The paper a couple of years ago by, who is it, Sincel and Krolik, who's not here, in which they said, you know, the real problem with this is that you can't, then the pulsar shouldn't be observed.
Well, where do you think that scattering is occurring? There was the issue.
They say it's inside the light cylinder, of course.
Well, yes, sir, but that is part of the pulse formation mechanism. It's almost certainly the propagation through the outer magnetosphere.
Yeah. That's true. But they say it should be absorbed. I mean, that's the outstanding thrust of their paper, is it they can't figure out why you see pulsars.
Well, there is a problem with the time right there, that you're liable to cyclotron absorption on the outgoing plasma.
Yeah.
If the particles go out along the field line, if you've got electrons and positrons, then you absorb both sides of polarization.
Yeah.
It's just an incoherent cyclotron radiation if you make it in the
there
are all these problems,
and but nature somehow solves all these. I mean, if we suggest we're missing something, I mean, because we do see them.
Right. One way of missing is to have the emission region outside of cyclotron.
Oh right. Oh right. Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, more details. Here's your sure thing.
Oh, yes, nobody knows. Amory is giving a talk this afternoon, apparently.
4 o'clock.
At 4 o'clock in Broida.
For physics seminar.
Yeah, it'll be the third floor of Broida.
What's the topic?
At 4 o'clock.
They're calling ADN and the pouch, the host pouch black hole connection.
Ah, good. Mm-hmm.
At 4.
At 4 in Broida.
Yeah. Steve just sent her out email, so you have that email notification as well.
There.
See, I'll trade you. Here's Carl Wins.
I don't know if he's there or anything.
Yes. Okay,
I'll give him a ring.
Yeah, I thought of him last night,
and
then I just forgot this morning.
Anyway, the other thing, could we scan the...
You want me to put them in order?
Well,
I was attempting to do that.
I think they were.
It doesn't matter. See, that's fine.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That's fine. That's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine.
I will.
That's good.
You know, I'm trying to remember the free electron laser literature. The mainline way to get the laser to be coherent is, of course, to have an externally imposed magnetic wave field.
However, there are also some schemes where you sort of make the bunches, so to speak, inside the beam itself.
I've done it.
Sort of reminiscent of this.
Exactly.
And in fact, there was a scheme at this laser. You know, fundamentally, it's a far infrared free electron laser. There are some schemes to get optical and near infrared radiation by some kind of scheme like that.